Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Vermont Law School's Environmental Hot Topics podcast. Vermont Law School's Environmental Law Center has offered lectures and programs from distinguished scholars, practitioners, activists, and public leaders for over a decade. Today, we bring the Vermont Law School Hot Topics lecture series to the web and to the world. My name is Rebecca Purdom, and I'm an associate dean at Vermont Law School. With me today is Victor B. Flatt. Professor Flatt joins us as Vermont Law's 2013 Distinguished Environmental Law Scholar. Victor Flatt is the Thomas F. and Elizabeth Taft Distinguished Professor in Environmental Law and Director of the Center for Law, Environment, Adaptation, and Resources at the University of North Carolina School of Law, as well as the Distinguished Scholar in Carbon Markets and Carbon Trading at the Global Energy Management Institute at the University of Houston's Bard College of Business. Professor Flatt's wide-ranging scholarship analyzes the application and enforcement of environmental laws. Today, we'll be talking with Victor Flatt about the considerations and challenges we face in managing all of our laws in the face of climate change adaptation. Thanks for joining us today, Victor. Climate change interferes with all sorts of established environmental laws. How is that? Why is that?
Well, climate change affects the natural world. Environmental laws are there to deal with perturbations in the natural world. And in fact, environmental laws are almost all based on the theory that there is sort of a natural steady state in the environment that we want to get to or get as close to as possible. And it turns out, of course, that climate change tells us it's a dynamic system. So it's changing the baseline of everything. So you have to rethink environmental laws and other laws in the face of climate change.
We typically talk about environmental laws in kind of two pockets. One is the pollution pocket,
right,
and one is the natural resource,
right,
kind of protection and management,
right,
pocket. Does climate change interfere with both of those?
Absolutely. The most obvious interference, I think, is with the resources themselves. You know, because the resources are natural, quote unquote, climate change, you know, heat, light, weather, precipitation are inputs into this natural environment, how the biota grow and migrate and live and reproduce and all of these things. But it also affects pollution because of the way pollution forms. It's affected by heat and precipitation and various other things. And the way humans respond to the changed world can also change the things we're making and what we're doing and how much we use a certain thing, like more air conditioning, so that also can affect the pollution as well.
We're recording this in the summer of 2013 when we're seeing these horrible fires out in New Mexico. And one of the things we're hearing from the folks who manage the natural resources out in the West, particularly forests, is that the management regimes they used to use don't seem to work as well when you have incredible fire, or excuse me, incredible droughts, for example.
Right.
So how could environmental laws adapt to even deal with that?
Well, I think they have to go back and revisit their central premise that we have a steady state natural environment. To the extent we have had for a while, that's fine. I'm not even sure we have, but at least for the history of what we've thought about in terms of our environment, we have. But that's changing. And so you have to see where the stress points are, and you have to revisit what you can do. And that's not always easy. Hopefully, you can still meet your original purpose, like protect human health or protect a forest or whatever, but at some point, climate change may get so bad that it even challenges that, and you really have to even rethink where you're going at that point.
Now, we're talking about environmental laws, but you're actually looking broader than just environmental laws. You're looking at the stresses that climate change puts on the legal system generally.
Right.
I think it's kind of obvious in the natural resource protection area, for example, but how does climate change affect other kinds of laws?
Well, the natural resources provide the whole system on which human society is based, right? All the inputs, everything we do, and pollution is an outcome of all of those inputs. And so to the extent climate change changes any part of the natural environment, it changes everything that's built on the natural environment, including our whole system of laws that have grown up over time. And they may be once removed, twice removed, three times removed, or four times removed, but because of human society's still connection to the natural world, everything we do is related to the natural world in one form or another. And so when you have climate change, when it changes something in the system, that in turn will change something else that will change something else that may affect a different kind of law that you don't even think about as being related to the natural environment, like patent law or banking law or something like that.
How would patent law or banking law get impacted by climate change? I'm curious. Can you give us examples?
Let's go with banking law. So let's assume banking law. One of the things we've seen in the recent collapse of the financial system is a response, banks have to capitalize more. They need to have more capital in case certain things go wrong. What happened in the housing crisis? Everything happened simultaneously in a direction that no one predicted. Well, let's say you have a drought on a scale that has never before been seen. Then all of the loans and insurance and collateral that is tied up in all of that, you know, cropland and property may be destroyed simultaneously, you know, completely undercutting an entire financial system. And if you're not even prepared for that possibility, you get to this point where everything else collapses. If you're at least prepared for the possibility and have some backup plan or something in place to assist with that, or have thought about it ahead of time, perhaps you can avert the worst possible disaster. So in banking law, maybe we need to think about what reserves or how much people should depend on resources or various other things.
So the bank that's highly invested in real estate in New Mexico right now, if they had kind of one investment down there, they're in big trouble.
Right.
And banking law may tell them if you're going to invest in a potentially arid spot, you also have to invest in, you know, Northwest Canada.
Right. It's kind of almost like looking at like the same thing the insurance industry almost does, sort of, although they don't always do that well either, as we know, because they're basing their stuff on actuarial tables, which are based on the past, which, you know, doesn't tell us as much about the future.
So you're looking at some kind of, you call it a template, but you're looking to try to find some kind of mechanism to reform not just environmental laws. Right. We'll talk about what that is, but you're looking to reform the entire legal system in light of climate change. Is that really necessary?
I think it is. Let me back up. It will happen in some way or in some fashion, but to me, if we approach it more thoughtfully and with an eye towards what we want to do and accomplish, it will at least happen consistent with our broad societal goals and aspirations. If we don't do it that way, no telling what's going to happen or who's going to win and who's going to lose. And it strikes me that will be both inefficient and unfair.
This is heady stuff. We're going to reform the entire legal U.S. legal system and possibly the international legal system under the stuff that you're proposing. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to take some time to talk about the tools you're proposing to even approach the question. But before we get there, is it necessary? Let me ask it differently. Do you have to have a toolbox to go into this conversation? And if you do, where do you find that toolbox?
Okay. I think having a toolbox is helpful because I think you can systemically approach most legal frameworks. And I think the systemic approach allows you to understand what's important about the reformation. The problem is if you don't have that or haven't at least thought about it, and maybe somebody else would think about it and come up with a different version or multiple versions of what else is important. If you don't think about that, then you miss things that are critical and that lead again to this concept of inefficiency and unfairness and economic injustice and all the other things that I was referring to.
So what toolbox are you using?
Well, I said it's my template for approaching a law. I base the template on reviewing work that other scholars have done, looking at how should we respond to a world that is no longer static but dynamic and changing, and trying to glean some big points from those. Then with those big points, I ask myself, what can we do in a systemic way, a template, to change or approach or possibly change a law while keeping in mind these goals, which are important factors, which I think have been vetted and discussed by some other scholars as well. So if you want to talk about the template itself,
sure.
Essentially it's triggered at first by what I call a stress point. And that is that if you haven't had a point where a law seems unable to cope with this change in an dynamic world, probably you're not going to start there, mm-hmm. right? And as you point going to re-examine every single law in every single jurisdiction sounds a bit much. So you're thinking of prioritization. Although, one could imagine a systemic approach to this as well, which I will come back to. But let's say you're prioritizing. So it's triggered by a stress point. Somebody realizes that, wait a minute, every time this happens, this isn't working.
Every time we have a hurricane on the East Coast, something's not working.
Right. Or something as simple as zoning in Keechee, Vermont, says you can build housing here, and yet the floods are getting more and more severe and intense. So probably we shouldn't be building houses there. So, that's something we need to change. All right. Well, do we just go and change it? Well, no, we have to think about why we're changing it, and we have to think about originally why the law was in place, and also the economic implications of distributive justice. So let's say that it happens to be a very poor community that is in the floodplain, which is quite typical. Maybe not in Vermont, but in a lot of other parts of the country it is. And you know, just to say you can't build there doesn't recognize the reality of an existing community. It doesn't recognize the reality of the fact that people need places to live. It's like the theories in the 40s and 50s where they just destroyed low-income housing, but didn't necessarily rebuild comparable housing or communities. So you have to keep in mind what it is you're changing. And once you do that through the lens of justice and efficiency, you rethink. Okay, well, we can't have people here, but we know that we need a place for people with low income or workers or people who already have an established community. Where can we do that that is safe? And how can we do it in the most cost-effective way possible?
Now, you just used a word I want you to unpack a little bit. You said efficiency. Is efficiency just something that's cost-effective?
Efficiency, in theory, is the best way to do things. But, of course, that begs the question, what is best? Which means you're having to account for a whole system of values. So, for instance, in the environmental field, we often critique cost-benefit analysis, which is presumably efficient because we say it doesn't look at the real values or fully engage the real values of the natural environment or various other things. So there can be problems with any definition of efficiency or cost efficiency or anything like that. I refer to it mainly to indicate that if we are going to make a change, we want to do it in the way that is best for the most people at the least cost, because as we define that, because everything comes with a cost, and we want, if we move some a community here and we don't do it efficiently or effectively, we may not be able to do it over here. And so that's sort of what I mean by that. And everybody can bring their own definitions to that of what it means to be efficient.
Mm-hmm. Efficiency can have, I think, some people have a squirm a little bit with the word efficiency,
right,
but people squirm even more at the word inefficiency. We don't want to be inefficient.
Right, exactly.
And I want to back up to this idea of stress points, mm-hmm. that often it's tough to reform anything until we actually hit the hiccup or hit the glitch. But why is that difficult to define? Why aren't the stress points, particularly in light of climate change, really obvious to everyone and propel this reform fairly easily?
Well, I think part of the reason in the United States is that climate change is politicized. And so that's a strange, to me, occurrence related to the political world that I don't completely understand. But because it is politicized, that means that to recognize something as being affected by climate means you have taken a political position. And in a system that we have with two parties that are very much non-cooperating, it becomes very difficult to do that. And so those whose political lives are based on there not being climate change don't want to recognize a stress point to the climate, because that means that it undercuts one of their primary ways of looking at the world.
So even when an event occurs that you might attribute to climate change and say this is a climate change-based stress point, someone else might identify it as a stress point from a different cause.
Correct. And I think a very good example of that, let's not even get into storms or anything like that. There's dispute about, which of those are traceable to climate change or whatever, or how much. But something about a change in habitat for a species. The nighttime temperatures don't get as low, so it doesn't, the pine bark beetles are not destroyed, so they reproduce rapidly and they're able to munch and control and, you know, go crazy and get rid of all kinds of pine trees, which causes more forest fires and with all the droughts and various other things. Now, if you look at that from the point of view of climate change, you know, okay, that temperature warming, that's on average changing. It's not going back in any soon time scale. If you're not a believer in climate change, you may say, well, yeah, the nighttime temperatures are higher, but that's just random. It could change next week or the next time the sun goes through a sunspot cycle. So that means you're not, you don't see the need to alter an existing legal structure because you're still assuming the world is in a steady state environment.
So this is tough. If your template starts with find the stress point, and the stress point itself is politicized, how do you overcome that problem or that challenge?
You don't. I mean, you do, but you do it in the same way you overcome any political stress point. And you'll note that I really think about when we're approaching these laws and when we get to the point of where we have to make a decision about changing something, that has to be in a representative elected government. And people will certainly scoff at that in this framework time, of at least at the federal level, because they say they can't do anything. And I respond, that may be true at this point, but if you don't at least frame it and flag it in that way, something's going to happen anyway, and it may happen without any thoughtful or careful input. And that, to me, is also a very bad outcome. And at least you can say, if you frame it correctly for the body politic, if they don't respond, at least you can have the public being able to tell what they're not doing.
And you actually write that where you think reforms are appropriate, you'd rather see them done through a democratic process than through an administrative process.
Yes.
Which is interesting to me because it seems like, if for efficiency's sake, if you gave it to a bunch of middle managers, they might be able to implement it faster than at least our current congressional system.
Correct. And there are two reasons I don't propose that. In fact, this is one of the reasons I wanted to write about this, because it struck me that when a lot of people were looking at adaptation in the resource management context, they were looking at it solely from the lens of the administrative state, that we want to give the middle managers, as you say, or the people that implement the laws, resiliency or a larger space in which to alter the implementation. My problem with that is that even well-dedicated civil servants are not necessarily responsive to the public's interest as expressed in original legislative goals. You know, it's awful sausage making, but at least you've made some sausage, as opposed to you have somebody working completely outside the system. Even a very, very good civil servant, they might do what most of the public would want, but my fear is they will focus on one area of expertise, perhaps more than another, and miss some things that are very important that would come out in an open debate.
I'm a water manager. I manage this river, and it means that I'm not paying necessarily attention to the settlement needs of the folks who may have had houses in this floodplain who get moved out because I said no more houses in the floodplain, but we don't
right.
find new
right.
housing opportunities for them.
Exactly, because you know you have a hammer and everything's a nail. The other reason is more of an empirical one, and I can't remember if I discussed this in this paper, but I did an empirical study. I was asked by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to examine their legal authority to make changes about managing dams and rivers in the Southeast. And specifically, they're under a typical natural resource management tool called a multiple-use management paradigm, which is you want to manage whatever, the river, the dam, to maximize benefits. And here we go back to what are benefits and what's efficiency. Maximize benefits across water, flood control, recreation, transportation, electricity production, and maybe environmental amenities. All right, well, so the Corps theoretically has that authority, and yet they don't know or are afraid to use it to its maximum extent possible because they sort of realize, who are we to be making this decision, you know, in the great flood in Nashville, historic flood in 2011, that unprecedented. They had a choice 2 days before. Did they release, you know, or actually months before, how much water do they release, knowing that if they don't release enough, they could cause devastating floods, but if they release too much, they may not have enough water for agricultural irrigation or for electricity production or for transportation? Is it their job to decide, are human lives more important than this economic system of these rural farmers? Is it their decision to decide how much lives are more important than them or not? Or these are very difficult questions. And I, you know, of course, everybody's punching bag, but I feel sorry for them because they are put in an almost impossible situation and asked to make decisions in many cases that should be made by Congress. And what they end up doing, of course, is they don't make a decision at all. They just say, we've always done it this way, we'll continue to do it this way. Which brings us back to the problem with the static environment when we now have a changed or dynamic environment.
It's interesting. You're ascribing more humility to the Army Corps than I think most folks
typically. I guess it depends on what district you're in, actually, but I'll put it that way.
Probably, but it sounds even for somebody who's fairly magnanimous, being told to balance 8 or 9 variables is almost impossible. I mean, even the best jugglers can't really do that very well.
Right.
And you're saying that some of these laws, even before we get to the question of stress points,
right,
are already difficult to implement, right, and already have maybe too many pieces to them.
I think that's true. I mean, I think climate change has exacerbated that. I think historically there was this theory that, you know, we just keep piling on these things and you possibly could balance, like with a lower population, with less demand for electricity, less demand for drinking water, less demand for agriculture, less demand for endangered species. You know, before the Atlanta metro area had almost 6 million people, you could manage Lake Lanier in a way that preserved the Oyster Bays and the Apalachicola Bay. So you could do it all. You know, I could do it all. But now you can't. And then climate change just takes it one step further.
Just ramps
it
up.
Worse. Right. Right.
So your template, you say we're going to look for the stress points, mm-hmm, first of all, and we've talked about that, and then you're going to address those stress points, but you make an interesting point in the light of the original purpose of the statute.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. We have laws for a reason. Sometimes those reasons may not be well thought out, but we have to assume that once they're there and they've been there for a while, they're validated to some extent. And those purposes were arrived at, those goals were managed, the law created to meet those goals by this democratic process. And so before we go changing willy-nilly the law, it's important to understand why it was there in the first place, because if we don't do that, we may be missing a whole interest entirely, and particularly in today's world where we already know that Congress is not eager to look at goals that seem to be less economic, like environmental protection or protection of the poor or various other things. I think it's very important to keep that framework in mind, or the original goals in mind. Because then at least you can say, wait a minute, what are you going to do about this community that's being blockaded? What are you going to do about this ecosystem that, you know, was supposed to be preserved when this was put into place? They can, of course, Congress could and might say, we don't care. But at least they've then taken the public stance of we don't care. And rarely do you actually hear a congressperson, even one who considers themselves very conservative, say, I hate the environment, or I hate poor people. Or,
right.
It's hard to say that, right? And so forcing people to put the truth out there, I think, is very important. And that's why I think the original goals are so important to understand.
Are those original goals always easy to ascertain?
Not necessarily. I mean, this is just like a court that tries to interpret a law. You know, the poor D.C. Circuit, I think, spent 4 pages on discussing what the word any meant in Section 110 of the Clean Air Act, which is just horrific for most environmental law students. But you look at the same kinds of things. You look at legislative history, and you sort of look at how it's gone over time, sort of how it's been validated, how it's worked in practice, and you can have a discussion about it, right? People may disagree about what the original intent was, but again, you bring that up, and by bringing it up, you put it in the light of the discussants.
Some scholars have suggested getting rid of the current legal regime, that it's antiquated, that it's not relevant, particularly in light of both modern economic conditions and in light of climate change, and that we just need a whole new regime. You're obviously arguing for the opposite, but answer those folks for a minute. Why not clear the slate and just put the right thing down?
Who says what the right thing is? And, okay, let's say I say, well, okay, the body politic says what the right thing is. All right, fine. Let's do it. Let's get them to consider everything simultaneously at one time and systemically go through everything they're doing and write a whole new system. And in some, you know, other parts of the world, they do this. They have got new constitutions. They have civil law programs where they really can revisit a big thing. But let's say we can do it in the United States. If you can do that, you know, more power to you, but I find it hard enough to keep in mind the original goals of one law, let alone all the laws simultaneously. And sometimes you have to look at more than one law. You know, you may need to move things together or take away one or keep one in the light of another. And so what you end up getting is a patchwork quilt, but I often think a patchwork quilt is easier to mend and repair than weaving a whole new blanket from scratch, which, you know, can be very difficult. And in the United States also, we have a federal system. So our state laws and our local laws, in turn, are based on their connections to the federal system. And recreating an entire federal system would mean, presumably, you have to recreate entire state systems as well, and then down to the local level.
So I want to back up for a minute. We talked a little bit about a toolbox. You've got this template that you say right. We could impose on all sorts of different kinds of laws. But you've also drawn a little bit from what the natural resources legal world has talked about. And in that space, you've talked really about two terms. One is scale, and one is systems. And I'd like to unpack both of those for a minute. When we talk just about systems, I'm going to ask you, when you talk about systems, what are you really talking about when we look at the way that law works coming out of the natural resources legal field?
There can be two sort of ways. One can be the natural system itself, like how does the system itself work and interact, and then law is just kind of a thing that tries to recognize that and maximize whatever goals or benefits you're looking at. Or the system could be the entire group of laws that work with that natural resource or group of natural resources. And then that system could be, you know, the Endangered Species Act plus NEPA plus the BLM's Multiple Use Management, National Forest Management Protection Act, plus local zoning, plus a state forest, plus, you know, so you get all these different things. So system to me means that you recognize that things are interrelated and interlocked. So that in some ways seems to work against just taking a particular law, but when you take a particular law, you see where it goes, and you do the best you can to keep those things from fraying completely, or at least understand what you're doing if you fray them. And then, of course, scale refers to the effect of where do we make that change? What stress point? You know, and it's easy to think about this in the United States because we do have a federal system. We know we have different sovereigns at the state level and at the federal level that operate in different spheres, but whose impacts overlap. And one of the reasons to use law as a system or scaffolding for making natural or climate change adaptation changes is the current law already recognizes those distinctions and the way these things interact. So being aware of scale, and Hari Ossofsky's written a lot about this, being aware of scale is very important in terms of thinking about how you approach a law and which law you're going to approach. I would just add, you know, one thing about that. I think I also state that when you're making a decision in the democratic system, you know, the elected legislature, it should be at the lowest level possible because of, you know, theories that go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine, that the more local you are, the better, the more responsive to the needs of the public you will be. And particularly when you think about climate change adaptation, which can be particularly localized, or climate change can be particularly localized, it's important to think about at what level you're making those decisions.
But that's interesting. I think some listeners would say, wait a second, you're talking about doing something at the local level, but climate change is this global event. So, you know, does it matter that the city of Keene, New Hampshire has decided to go carbon neutral or that they've planted extra buffers? Does that really have an impact when you're dealing with something that's on where climate change is on such a global scale?
Well, in there you're referring to two different things. So climate change mitigation would be the idea of going carbon neutral, like we're trying to stop the climate from changing even more. And my response to that is everybody sort of has their own responsibility to do that. And the fact that so many local governments have done that, I think, is very interesting and telling. And I think they derive benefits from it that may not be we're stopping climate change personally, but we are a model, we influence other people, we raise our citizens' awareness, various other things. The other part, like planning buffer zones and stuff, that's an adaptation thing. And there, I think local governments have to be completely involved because they're the ones that see whether or not they're having a flood there, or they're having a more arid season, or they're having new pests or new disease vectors or various other things. You could have a climate impact that's very isolated. I mean, it can be large, but it can be isolated. And so, you know, if you have increased riverine flooding from huge storm events in Vermont and New Hampshire, well, the federal government has to think about that because they have to think about how they respond to disasters. They have to think about the National Flood Insurance Program, but so do the state of Vermont and the state of New Hampshire. They have to think about where their citizens live and where they're building and how they zone things and what they're doing. So that's an example of how every level of government will respond in their sphere.
You mentioned this idea of adaptation, and I think this goes back to something you said before, that as we mold laws to respond to climate change, or as the democratic process might respond to climate change and change some laws, you're a little nervous about the idea that we adopt a term that the natural resource world has used called adaptive management. Mm-hmm. Can you describe, first maybe tell us what adaptive management is, and then tell me why you're nervous about taking that concept into other legal frameworks.
Adaptive management in the natural resource context came up sort of in the 90s, and the idea was that we face uncertainty in managing a complex natural system, and so we may want to learn and go back and change what we do. Adaptive management tells us that if you do one thing, you're the Forest Service, let's say, and it turns out it's not working, then you use that as information to tell you to make another decision. In theory, that's of course logical, right? We all take in new information, we all change our behavior based on new information. That's great. And it also superficially makes sense with climate, because the very fact of climate change is new information. New stuff is happening, things are changing. I see two problems with it, though. One of the problems is the same problem with making changes at the administrative level, that you're having the change made at a level that may not be taking into account all the factors that are necessary. And obviously that's a continuum. You know, at some point, yes, of course you want people to have flexibility to make changes on certain things. And certain things are more technical and technocratic, and certain things are more principled. But then the second thing is, it turns out it hasn't really worked. And that's because nobody, you know, people aren't sure when to take a new information, when to revisit or change. It's not my job. It goes back to the core example. They may have the power to do it, but they're not really sure when or where or how they should do it or to what extent they should do it. So to me, if you're going to have adaptive management, you need, and in this context, you could apply it to laws. You would need to make it much more specific for both what field you can adapt, you know, what areas, and trigger events, which make you do it. In other words, you don't just wait for the person to respond. You say, if X happens, then you must revisit this management system. And that's another way to approach laws in a comprehensive way. I mean, I've talked about the stress points, but it is possible, and the state of North Carolina has done this, they have required all of their agencies to examine all of the regulatory systems to decide how they should be changed in the face of climate change. And again, though, they're sort of like, well, what do we do? So our center sort of helped them by creating an interactive online thing that had specific trigger points for them. You know, is your regulatory system affected by more rain? Is your regulatory system affected by an increase in sea level? Is your regulatory system affected by droughts? It may not cover everything, but at least they had triggers that let them know when they needed to examine it or make a change.
It wasn't just a land manager that said, gee, we seem to have fewer bunnies this year.
Right.
I'm going to change the way I manage the brush.
Exactly.
So if we take your template, let's say the federal government says, okay, this is it. We're going to take this template and we're going to start applying it across the board to various laws. Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of what that would look like?
Sure. So I was most interested recently in how it looks at disaster management and response. And we've both seen an example of parts of the template being applied without people calling it a template or response, saying it's my idea, because that's just how people naturally respond, and then you see sort of where it could be improved. So an example in natural disaster response is that money to rebuild, which is allocated by Congress through the Stafford Act, requires that rebuilding occur in its current location. And we've seen the governor of New Jersey and the governor of New York saying this isn't what we need to do because we have citizens that are too vulnerable, yet they can't just move somewhere, so why not take the money to rebuild and let them build somewhere else?
A more safer place.
We won't be, increasing costs in both human life and in response and various other things. And so that shows stress. Like, climate change has created a stress point on the Stafford Act. which is its basic desire that you rebuild in place. But we know climate change means you continue to put people in harm's way, it's inefficient, it's dangerous, etc. Well, why did we have that? Let's look at the prior goals. We wanted the Stafford Act because we want to provide assistance to people who, through no fault of their own, have been a victim of natural disaster. We want to do it in an efficient way, but historically there was also concern about fraud and not spending too much money. And so this fraud was one of the reasons they required them to rebuild in place so they wouldn't sort of game the system or take it somewhere else or something else. And so that's something that we still have to examine, because we still know that in these massive federal programs of aid, disaster response, there can be fraud. It's a lot of money. So how do we manage that issue while still taking into account that people may need to rebuild and or move communities somewhere else? So what's interesting to me is we actually saw the governors of New York and New Jersey identifying the stress point. This isn't working. We need to change. What we haven't seen yet is a reexamination of the goals, an open debate. We have seen some debate in Congress, but it's more veered toward we need to stop giving disaster response money at all. And that will encourage people to change where they live, and et cetera, et cetera. Don't create a moral hazard. And reforming the National Federal Insurance Program to raise the rates so people won't be incentivized to build in these coasts and stuff. So you see a somewhat loose and haphazard response, but not a full discussion of all the issues.
It sounds like a good example of applying these principles. Do you think we're going to be faced with other opportunities to apply them across other areas of law, particularly as climate change impacts increase?
Oh, absolutely. Another example that just jumps into mind that you all are focusing on a lot at Vermont are agricultural laws and the subsidies that are given by the federal government to grow and use certain crops in certain ways. These are problematic to me in a lot of levels, but they are becoming more problematic in with respect to how climate change is affecting these. And I'll just give you two ways. One is some crops can't grow in the same places they're growing, not as efficiently. And some of these laws are based on rotating particular crops and subsidies for particular crops. Second, the increase in high-intensity precipitation events in major river systems, particularly the Mississippi-Missouri system and the Ohio system, creates more runoff problems, more of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which has been a problem but is getting worse and worse, the same with the Chesapeake Bay. So that says there's another reason, because climate change is making the downside of this federal program worse. So that we should be revisiting the federal program on how we're looking at agriculture.
So it's pretty ambitious to say I'm going to come up with guidelines to reform all of U.S. law. I mean, it's a pretty big project.
Right.
When you started in on this, what did you expect to find? What, as you started examining what was there, and I'm going to ask you two questions at once. What did you expect to find, and what surprised you?
I actually went in with my own ideas of what I thought I'm thinking will happen. And because I've been thinking about this for a long, long time. I've been thinking about adaptation. I've been thinking about how laws change. I've been thinking about how things are interconnected and that sort of thing. So I did find, what I found that I was happy about finding was that a lot of the work that has been done both on legal systems in general and climate change adaptation in the natural resource context recognize some of the same issues and values. You know, the original goals proposals, that you look at original goals, that you have to look at which level you're doing it, that you have to look at the difference between administrative and legislative. And so I was glad to see that that was out there. So what I hoped I brought to that is kind of pulling all those strands together and being able to write it up in a way that would have an impact or have an influence. I've been thinking about this idea for a long time. I wanted to do what I would say is a go-to comprehensive essay about adapting law, kind of a review of what else is out there and then trying to come up with a way to use those lessons to do something.
Has anyone else picked this up? Have you had a call from Congress saying, come down and teach us how to do this?
We've used it, and was saying, in North Carolina to help the agencies. I've, you know, talked with people in disaster response area, more at the agency level, not at Congress. We I have been in touch with Senator Whitehouse and I guess it's Senator Wyden. I'm trying to remember who've proposed that we look at climate change adaptation more clearly. So and the president's staff, Nancy Sutley, the head of the Commission on Environmental Quality, they have this idea that we should look comprehensively at climate change adaptation, and some agencies have done it and some agencies have not. I would like the idea of systematic ways to approach this to get to that level. And I'm not sure it's quite there yet, but I'm hoping it will.
Well, let's hope it rises up and you get a call from the White House here soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Vermont Law School Environmental Hot Topics podcast. We hope you can join us for future podcasts on this channel. For more information about Vermont Law School's environmental programs, including links to talks by experts interviewed here, please visit the Vermont Law School Environmental Law Center page at www.vermontlaw.edu/ELC. This has been Rebecca Purdom for Vermont Law School's Hot Topics podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this program.